Also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, May 25th, 2000, remains etched in Lebanon's collective memory as a day of triumph and resilience, a day when the long-occupied lands of South Lebanon were finally liberated from Israeli Zionist occupation. Today, Lebanon celebrates 25-year anniversary of that liberation. Now, with the strongest Arab armies of the time failed to achieve, Hezbollah resistance movement delivered for the proud Lebanese people. Now, the holiday is celebrated with parades, rallies, ceremonies, political marches, and speeches, especially in the south of Lebanon, where people were most affected by Israel's invasion. Now, the significance of this liberation, of Hezbollah's role in Lebanon, its evolution in politics, military strength, and popular support, and threats posed by Israel and its allies to Lebanon's sovereignty and people are the focus of today's Spotlight program. But first, a quick report by Mariam Saleh.
The 25th of May is celebrated in Lebanon as a national holiday, a day of liberation and resistance. 25 years on, they recall a historic victory, and the Israeli regime recollects what they see as a humiliating defeat.
The blood of martyrs was fruitful, and it was this liberation that gave us dignity and strength to remain steadfast. It instilled in us a firm belief that this liberation will lead to more victories and that this enemy can be defeated.
We will not rest until we liberate the rest of our land. I'm 91 years old, but I'm always ready to fight. Two of my sons are martyrs and we're ready to sacrifice more.
In May of 2000, 144 Lebanese prisoners remained in the prison cells here in the Khiyam prison even after the Israeli occupation forces withdrew and their mercenaries fled the site. And as the southern towns fell one after the other in the hands of the resistance, the people of South Lebanon flocked into the prison and released the prisoners with their bare hands.
The liberation in 2000 and the new victory are very important to us. We know that we have a great resistance that defends us and will not allow the Israelis to take this land.
We are all loyal to the path of resistance. Even if they think of entering our land, we will fight them.
The people here believe that it is necessary and these sacrifices are necessary to secure Liberation Day and to prohibit another Israeli occupation of their land. They believe that resistance will continue as long as the Israeli threat persists. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And now for our guests. Joining us, Sondos Al-Assad, Lebanese journalist, joining us from the Lebanese capital. And Daniel Yegig, author and researcher, also joining us from Beirut. Hello to the both of you. It's a pleasure to have you both on. Welcome to our Spotlight program. Sundos, we're going to start with you, if we may. 25 years ago, Israel was driven out, beleaguered from Lebanon in what was the first time, actually, that Israel was forced to retreat while receiving nothing, no concessions, no deals or agreements, as just stated moments ago in address by Sheikh Naim Qassem, Hezbollah chief, in his speech on this liberation anniversary occasion. What do you think that day, Sundos, meant for the Lebanese people?
Yes, thank you for having me. First of all, congratulations for the Lebanese people in particular and for the, all the free nations across the globe who are fighting imperialism and Zionism. This auspicious day that reminds us when the people of South Lebanon have been able to defeat the Zionist occupation, which has been ever since backed by the American administrations and unfortunately by a group of Lebanese officials and also some Arab regimes. On that day, the Lebanese have been freed from the occupation. And you know what that means, being for 18 years under occupation. And even before the occupation of the 1982, Lebanon has been under the Israeli attacks ever since the Zionist colonial entity have been established on the historical Palestinian land. Our grandfathers talked to us about stories how the Zionist occupation and the Zionist army used to attack them and what the occupation then in the 1982 occupied Lebanon and invaded Lebanon. At that time, Hezbollah wasn't found. And those that now try to claim that Hezbollah is an Iranian arm or that Hezbollah has foreign interests or work doesn't work for the interests of Lebanon, we remind them at that time Hezbollah hasn't been founded. Hezbollah as a resistance righteous movement have been created as a reaction for the Israeli violations and the Israeli crimes. The report of your correspondent now mentioned the Qiyam prison, detention prison, where the Lebanese have been tortured, women, children, and even elderly. The Lebanese can't forget these horrors that they have faced by the Israeli occupation and the Lahad collaborators. So whenever you mention the 25th of May, it's a reminder that once the intention of rejection and revolution is found, then you can defeat this colonial entity. And on this special day, we can't forget the words of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah when he said that the Zionist colonial entity is weaker than a spider web.
Thank you for your initial thoughts there, Sundos. Daniel, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the conversation there, bud. And your thoughts now, your initial thoughts on 25 years of liberation, where Israel, you very well know, back in 1967, it dealt a quite a heavy blow to the Jordanian, the Syrian, and the, at that time, was it the Jordanian, Syrian, and Egyptian armies. And then here you are in the year 2000, suffering defeat at the hands of a couple thousand resistance fighters known as Hezbollah.
Exactly. And it's very important to look at the liberation in its proper political and historical context, because the Israeli regime is a first world nuclear armed power that exists as a proxy of the United States and as a symbol of colonialism and imperialism in this part of the world. And it was confronted by the people of Lebanon, people from the south who resisted and who had to resist. And Sheikh Naim Qassem, in his recent speech, also said that Lebanon cannot remain without confronting the Israeli enemy. And we can go back to 1948, in fact, when the Zionist terrorist militias were establishing a so-called state of Israel during the Nakba, when the vast majority of the Palestinians were expelled from their homeland of Palestine. That was also when crimes were committed on Lebanese territory against Lebanese civilians. So if we look at May 25, 2000, in the proper context, this is was a very revolutionary and powerful defeat of the people against this very powerful arm of U.S. Foreign policy that has committed, of course, unspeakable crimes beyond Palestine, including in Lebanon and in South Lebanon. And today, of course, the situation in the past months is again a very different one, where again parts of southern Lebanon are again under the Israeli occupation. And in fact, Lebanon's airspace is under complete Israeli occupation, which once again shows that the Israeli regime is a advancing settler colonial project that will not stop, and it seeks to grab as much land as it can in Palestine and Lebanon and beyond. And the current circumstances in Lebanon reiterate again the continuity of the resistance, and also the importance of the resistance, because the resistance was born out of the people and their necessity to defend themselves and to preserve or restore the sovereignty of their country.
Thank you, Daniel. And then Sonos, we should also tell our viewers about just yesterday, we wrapped up about 3 or 4 weeks of municipal and mayoral elections in two governors, especially Nabatea and the South Governorate. Nearly 80 municipalities secured victories by acclamation, which means uncontested wins for the Amal movement and Hezbollah resistance movement. This after Israel, you very well know, throughout the process, aggressively attacked these very neighborhoods and their surrounding areas to basically discourage people from getting out and voting. President Joseph Aoun consequently went down there personally to secure to a secure situation room to oversee the voting process. And he said, quote, "The will to live is stronger than death, and the will to build is mightier than destruction." Another reference to Israel's failed plots and schemes to divide, to intimidate, or discourage the Lebanese people from showing their solidarity with their resistance.
Yes, I want to refer here also for the words of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah after the victory of 2006, when they addressed the people of resistance. And when he said exactly to them, "You are the most honorable people, you are the most honorable nation," because, you know, during the recent U.S.-led aggression, Israeli aggression against Lebanon, the anti-resistance camp here in Lebanon, especially the Lebanese forces, wanted to make the election by excluding the Shia community or the Shia Dayo, the Hezbollah and Harakat Amal. But at that time, this rhetoric, this sectarian rhetoric against the people of resistance, and even are speaking amid the war, amid the Zionist genocide against the Lebanese people, the demolition of their homes, this anti-resistance team wanted to help the Zionist occupation, and we have been seeing this psychological warfare against the resistance people, the pro-resistance people, and the pro-resistance community. But now, as you have mentioned, the municipal elections, the numbers, and the votes have shown and reflected the public opinion, especially in the south and in Baalbek and the Bekaa, and even in Beirut, how the people still, for the day, with the line of resistance. Because as we have mentioned, that the resistance is not an odd not movement, but it's from the people. The resistance have been made from those people who have endured the miseries of occupation. And so now the numbers of the ballot and the election results have shown that the people are still trusting in the option of resistance, because they do examine what is going in Syria, and they do know, they have a long experience with the Zionist occupation, and they don't trust the American administration. But because at the end of the day, they know that that Washington and all the American administration, whether the Republicans or everyone, are only work in favor of the Zionist occupation and in favor of the Zionist colonial scheme.
Thank you there. And I'd like, Daniel, if you could also speak on the municipal and mayoral elections that got wrapped up yesterday. This is after a few weeks, and a couple weeks ago was in the capital, Beirut, where you have people from all different sects and religions. And for the first time, Hezbollah got three seats in Beirut. That was unprecedented. And in the other resistance strongholds, they saw 95% victories for Amal and Hezbollah. And why is this important? Because the Lebanese government referred to it as a tsunami win. This after the conflict with the occupation, that the occupation and Western leaders would have the world believe gave such a defeat to Hezbollah and its image, and that it turned the people against Hezbollah. But this election showed us what exactly, Daniel, the opposite.
Absolutely. And it shows once again that Hezbollah is part of the people. It has been elected by the people. And not just in the municipal elections that took place this month. Hezbollah also had the highest share of votes in the last elections, in the parliamentary elections in 2022 and in 2018. It is also very important to mention that in the electoral system in Lebanon employs a so-called sectarian system and a political system that's referred to as confessionalism. In which, of course, the distribution of seats is allocated according to the sect. And that has actually even disadvantaged Hezbollah, because there are some constituencies in the south where the number of voters who are represented by one representative are much smaller than other parts of the country. But despite all of this, of course, Hezbollah keeps winning elections because it is part of the people. And it represents, on the one hand, a Lebanese political party, but also a social, political, and economic organization, because it has provided necessary civilian infrastructure, healthcare, and social services to a significant part of the population. And at the same time, of course, it has been the most important deterrent against the Israeli regime, which is why Hezbollah continues to get this much international attention. And of course, within the Lebanese political system, there are smaller other parties that represent proxies of the United States, and to some extent also follow interests that are in line with Western imperial interests. So the political stage is very much contested, but I think the recent elections have once again shown that there is a trust, a continuous trust in Hezbollah among its constituencies. And also, I would just like to add briefly, we need to keep in mind that there has been a concerted effort among parts of the Lebanese political elite, as well as within the Arab world and internationally, to demonize and ostracize Hezbollah, to refer to it as an alleged Iranian proxy or as a so-called terrorist organization. And these are even terms that we see in Lebanese hegemonic media to some extent. And I don't think that any other political party in Lebanon has been faced with that many attempts to be discredited and demonized. And we can see how these attempts remain very unsuccessful, given the support that Hezbollah has from the people.
Thank you. And Sonos, today there are governments withholding funding to Lebanon, because Lebanon obviously needs to rebuild areas ruined by the U.S. Israeli war machine over the past year and a half or so. And that funding is stipulated on what? That Hezbollah disarms. My question to you, who is there to protect against the occupation, against aggression by Israel, the Lebanese people? What other Arab leaders are going to protect Lebanon if not for Hezbollah? What Western leaders? They're not letting the country extract any of its natural resources, oil or gas, saying it belongs to 70 what odd years old Israeli entity. They're not letting the country obviously rebuild ruined areas if Hezbollah doesn't do this or Hezbollah doesn't do that. It can't get a loan. The country cannot get a loan also unless the West is able to politically meddle and interfere with the Lebanese parliament. So There's so much. And my question to you, who's going to come? Which Western or even Arabic state is going to help the Lebanese people tomorrow in the face of Zionist aggression and occupation?
Yes, I've mentioned earlier that in the 1982, when the Israeli occupation regime invaded Lebanon, at that time Hezbollah wasn't been created. But as a reaction for this intervention and this invasion, also the intervention of the U.S. In the Lebanese affair, Hezbollah was created, and ever since Hezbollah has been shielding the sovereignty of the Lebanese land and of the Lebanese people. And over the course of 18 years, till the date of 25 of May, Hezbollah sacrificed a lot of martyrs in order to secure the sovereignty of the Lebanese land. Also, Hezbollah continued to establish this this defiance for the favor of Lebanon over the years, and we have seen how Hezbollah defended Lebanon during the 2006 war and during the Takfiri Wahhabi war that have been led by al-Junani militias against the Lebanese eastern villages and towns in the Bekaa. Also, we have seen what Hezbollah, the resistance, have done during the recent U.S.-led aggression against Lebanon, and how Hezbollah has succeeded in preventing the Zionist occupation from occupying even one village on the borders with the Palestinian occupied land. But we have seen that when Hezbollah, given the war and peace resolution for the government, we have seen that the Lebanese have failed to protect the Lebanese villages. We have seen how the Zionist occupation demolished the rest of the bordering villages during the ceasefire agreement, and how the Zionist occupation doesn't respect the 1701 UN resolution. Because, unfortunately, the current government is under Riyadh and Washington orders. They don't respect what the Lebanese public opinion wants from them to do. But we have seen the intervention of these embassies, the Riyadh and Washington embassies, in the Lebanese affairs, and this has been in favor of Zionist occupation, and even regarding the reconstruction of what have been demolished during the recent war. We have heard from Iraq that Iraq has been ready to support Lebanon and help Lebanon in this project. But unfortunately, the problem now is from the government, which is totally unsovereign and under the U.S. and Riyadh embassy's orders.
And Daniel, I'd like you to also speak on that. Today, Lebanon has five key areas, these hilltops still occupied by the Israeli entity, although they're supposed to leave as of November 27th. They got a couple extensions. They're still there. They're carrying out daily attacks in violation of the late November 27th ceasefire, over 3,500 violations that have led to over 600 injuries, over 200 Lebanese fatalities, you very well know. And they're asking them and their allies for Hezbollah to disarm. Sheikh Naim Qassem just earlier tonight said Hezbollah is a defensive, he emphasized this, a defensive resistance, one which refuses oppression and occupation. It is a path to guarantee the safety and sovereignty of a nation. Its weapons are only used to that end, not for aggression, only for defense, not to parade around, move around, shoot and bomb others, but simply a tool to deter threats to our people.
Exactly. As you mentioned, there are several parts in the south that are under an Israeli occupation, and we're finding ourselves in a situation where The Lebanese government is insisting on a diplomatic solution through the mediators who are part of the ceasefire, including the United States. And of course, this is very paradoxical, given that the Israeli regime is carrying out and live streaming the genocide in Gaza, not too far away from Lebanon, in complete, of course, disregard and violation not only of international law or any treaties, but of any sort of humanity. The Israeli regime is the embodiment of evil, as the entire world can see. And so it is, of course, very paradoxical then to have any sort of thought that that exact regime would adhere to any laws or international law in Lebanon, when it has been violating Lebanon's sovereignty for the past almost eight decades. And as you mentioned, in reference to Sheikh Naim Qassem's speech, the resistance has been defensive. It emerged out of the necessity to protect Lebanon, because in the 1980s, there was not only the Israeli occupation of the south, the Israeli occupation also had its own Lebanese proxy militia that was committing violence against Lebanese civilians and administering the occupation. At the same time, of course, there has been a weak state. So the resistance has been restoring that sovereignty. And as the other speaker also mentioned, defending Lebanon from the terrorist attacks that were coming from ISIS and related groups from Syria throughout the past 1.5 decades. But paradoxically, again, today, the term sovereignty is used by the opponents of Hezbollah to claim that Hezbollah was doing the opposite. And there has been a very strong media war against Hezbollah that has been fought in attempts to try to weaken its reputation. And we also need to mention that there is, to some extent, an anti-Shia sentiment, that there is sectarianism that is asymmetrical, that is oftentimes directed in particular against the Shia community, and in particular against the Shia community from the south, that often have been marginalized by the central state and have found themselves in the situations where they cannot rely on a state that has not taken their lives into consideration. And the ongoing situation now is, okay, of course, as Sheikh Naim Qassem has also stressed, that it is the state's responsibility. But a question really is, to what extent the state is willing or able to confront and protect Lebanon, to confront the Israeli enemy and protect Lebanon and its sovereignty from the continuous Israeli attacks.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both joining us here on our Spotlight program. Sonos Al-Assad, Lebanese journalist there, and also Daniel Yegig, author and researcher, both joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And that brings us, everyone, to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all of you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you. And here with me, I have my very dear sister.
This is Masuma.
Do you grow in silence or among others? Let's reflect on the power of solitude and togetherness. Well, Masuma, how do you improve? Together with the other people or in silence?
Let's start with the old me, when I was a teenager, and I was quite different. So I am a very extrovert person. I like to be among people. I am very social. I just love it. I just like when I see people. I might be, for example, I might be facing something very serious problem, maybe. I don't know, maybe university is going bad. But when I see people, just very naturally, I'm not pretending. Because I remember, right, I used to think maybe I'm pretending, but this occurs very naturally. I don't force it. This very happens. Oh, hi, hello, how are you? I'm good, thank you.
That's part of your personality.
Yeah, that is me. So I used to think that this is the only me and I should be only like that. And I remember that whatever would happen, I would be very open with it. Whatever would happen, I needed to tell someone. Oh, something great happened, I have to tell someone. Oh, wow. Something bad happened, I have to tell someone. Be it my friend, be it my teacher.
That's the definition of an extrovert person.
Yeah, so that was literally me. But now that I'm a little older, now that I am in this a little more mature side of my life, I am still keeping that part of my personality because that is me. I'm not going to change that because that's going to hurt me.
And it's nothing bad.
Yeah, it's nothing bad, of course. I'm very happy with it. I am very this butterfly person among social persons. But when I discovered the solitude, at first it was very weird because I had an introvert friend and she said that the real peace is when you have fun with yourself alone. Yeah. I was like, what do you mean, girl? How do you have fun when you're alone?
We recharge our batteries at that
time. Yeah, what do you mean by being alone? How can that be fun? But at some part of my life, when I had to be a little alone, I discovered, oh my God, there is
this
a
works.
Difference. Yeah, there's a difference between solitude and being lonely. So many people have this misunderstanding, especially many social butterflies, people like me, they thought being alone means being lonely. No, no, no. Lonely is something else. Being alone is something else. But solitude, that state when you are with you, is just very unique. And although we have so many hadith that, oh, do your prayers with jama'ah, with congregational, but also we have the namaz-e-shab and tahajjud to do at perfect solitude.
The prophet's retreat in Hira cave.
When you're all alone. So we can see that Islam even wants us to pay attention and experience both sides. So for the majority of my life, I was experiencing this being butterfly, being social, just being all on the other side. And when I was alone, I used to feel bad. But when I hit this part of my maturity and I realized, no, I can grow and I can keep some stuff to myself. I had a good day. I don't need to tell everyone. I can keep it within me. I can keep within this little bubble that I have created for me.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean I'm isolating myself from the rest of the community.
So this solitude is just this new aesthetic for me, which I like to keep it in my life. So sometimes when I have been out throughout the week because of my university, my job and all, I like to have this one day to be alone with me. Perfect solitude. Just me and me.
Well, you know, being raised and just growing as an introvert person, I always love this solitude and staying alone. And again, I can compare it to the past like you, but for me, it was confusing. You know, many people were asking me, okay, if you enjoy being alone and when you are so tired, you just go to the library alone. Does it mean that you don't like people?
Oh,
and many people thought about it this way.
Yeah.
That, okay, because you do not talk, it shows that you don't like to be with others. You're so shy or different labels.
Oh, are you okay?
Being shy, being shy. Yeah, being shy, being sad. But then when I grew up, when I got into the community more, I saw myself as one citizen, as one person in the society, having all the responsibilities, having the job and everything, being with people, but at the same time, deep down, saving that portion of time to recharge. When I said I will recharge my batteries by being alone, what I meant was that whenever an introvert person, because the introvert people are famous by their solitude, when they're being alone, it doesn't mean that they are depressed.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that they are shy. That
so
they
true.
Are, exactly. And this only means that you have to keep one portion of your life just for yourself, for your improvement, for the reflection. In Islam, we are advised, you really well mentioned that we are advised to pray in groups, be with the people, work in the community.
Yes.
But at the same time, the same religion mentions that every night before sleep, self-reflect.
Yes.
Reflect on everything that you've
done.
Islam doesn't mention keep your friends with you late at night, then think about all the things the group has done. So even in our religion, we are advised to keep one portion of life just for ourselves.
I would like to look at these two sides of human being as two flavors.
Right.
Just because you like chocolate does not mean you cannot enjoy vanilla. Now, I have really came to this point because I remember we used to label each other. Because I was literally labeled
shy, talkative.
Yes. I was labeled as being this extrovert, being social butterfly. So I thought my only growth, my only shining moment is when I'm among people. Yeah. If I have to shine, it has to be among people. If I want to be someone, I have to be among people. But I realized that these are just two sides that we need to use of both of it.
Yeah, and it's
really
important.
I need this time and I also need this time.
And for young people, this is really important to know.
Yes.
Okay, it's good to work in the society with the people, but will you stay in toxic groups?
So true.
Or will you go for the supportive solitude, which will help you improve?
Yes. In some situations, we need to make this very, very wise decision that sometimes just being in a group costs a lot. It costs our mental health. It costs our even spiritual health, where we can fall behind of our religious journey. So, of course, when we want to be social, we also need to take this factor in account that does it worth it? Does this align with my line or not?
I was too proud to see the truth and prostrate to you until I took the first step. And that's when you opened the doors for me. Now, alone, I realize what I was missing by being far from you.
Solitude is comfort for the intelligent and a prison for the foolish. This is the hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the meaning is really deep. What do you think Imam meant by foolish, by those people who are not aware of the meaning of solitude?
In this hadith, which is very thought-provoking actually, the words are quite simple. Intelligent, foolish, prison, no crazy words, very simple language, yet it is very thought-provoking. So we need to practice this and compare actually ourselves with that. That do I enjoy solitude or is it a prison? Now, actually, this is my first time I'm coming up across this hadith that now that you mentioned. Thank you so much. I think this was the rizq of my day. Because back then, when I was a teenager, for me, it was a prison. When I was at home, for example, the day that I didn't go out, maybe I used to be like, oh my God, I'm missing. I'm not having fun. This is so bad. I want to be out or I want to invite someone. So I remember that time it was a little prison for me. Yeah. But now that I'm thinking, it is very peaceful. It is a choice I make. This is not something that I am forced to have or it is implied on me rather than I'm choosing it. And now that I'm thinking, yes, I was not that intelligent back then either. So just love this hadith so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the other thing about this prison for the foolish can be that those people who are labeling other parts of the society, me being your friend, when I call you and say, okay, hey, are you coming out with me today? And you say, no, I need some time to refresh. Yes. When I start to label you that moment as a person, okay, why are you being depressed? What happened?
I know, right?
The moment that I feel a person is being alone, is being in solitude, and that person is being depressed, this is the moment that I'm going to be that person who is making a prison out of solitude.
So
this is the other perspective for the rest of the society, for those people who in the Islamic societies, they are not a lot. But still, those few people who feel like being in solitude, that keeping that solitary moment means you're going to be depressed, you're going to be imprisoned. So this has the other perspective as well. So let's go for a short break, and then I'm going to talk about another factor, which is keeping the balance between solitude and social life.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. You're listening to Youth Station. We're talking about solitude or loneliness.
Yeah, and keeping the balance between solitude and social life. This is a challenge.
Indeed, it is.
Used to be a big challenge for me. These days that I'm getting older, I'm getting used to it.
Yes.
Back then when I just got to enter the society, I got stressed for every situation that I had to be in. And a little by little, I got used to this routine that as a citizen, as a teacher, as a daughter of the family.
Actually, you learned the social skills, I think. You learned the communication skills.
Exactly. And I just had it fixed in my mind that you're going to have your social life as well. But many people, there are many teenagers, many of the young people who still find it confusing. Even I myself, still, in some situations and occasions, I have to make a decision.
Yes.
Am I going to enter this place or I can just make some excuses and be free of the parties that they have to go, for example. So there is the need for balance.
Of course there is. And one thing that I really like to mention is that this labeling is very common, we see, as I was labeled as being excited and being extrovert and all. So this made me misunderstand the fact that I cannot enjoy solitude. And I used to think that loneliness is something that is imposed on me.
Yeah.
But now I realize that this is something I can freely choose it. Again, in your case, I think you were labeled as being shy, depressed. Well, no, you just liked it. That was your comfort zone.
That was the way I could improve as a person.
Indeed. So I think this labeling is very foolish thing to do because we human beings have different dimensions in different situations. So in many situations, I am very extrovert, but in some scenarios, I am very introvert, and that is just the choice I make. This is nothing, this is no labeling. We're not just little products that have only one dimension. We are humans and we have different dimensions. Yeah. We need to embrace them and enjoy it and get the best of it for our own growth.
So true. And at the same time, we're not saying that we need to forget about the righteous company and how it can improve us. I need to be in the group of people, in the group of those who can help me. We need to keep them both, but we need to be aware of the differences and of the importance of each of them in our life.
Again, our motto, balance is the key.
Yeah, exactly. So the righteous company can help us improve the way we are being a citizen, the way we are working in the community, the way we are keeping every responsibility as a Muslim, since we still need, there is a call for Muslim collaboration, for us standing next to each other in this world, which is threatening us the whole time. There is this need, and we need to keep in mind that, okay, solitude is something to refresh. That is the moment of recharging. But this world needs active Muslims as well. Needs Muslims in groups and a society while keeping that moment to themselves as well. Well, I think we are reaching the end of this episode.
Yes.
And let's end today's episode by mentioning that balance brings growth.
Indeed it does.
Keeping the balance and choosing our silence and at the same time our circles wisely can show us the way. Well, this was all for today's Youth Station. Until another time, wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Are there so many converts in Austria? And why enjoys Austria a unique status on its law of Islam? Fact. thoughts and questions that make me curious. I pack my suitcase in Germany and make myself to Austria. During my stay there, I will meet numerous Austrian converts. And as there are as many reasons for conversions as there are converts, each has his or her individual story. Jasmin Bartel is a 20-year-old girl from Linz with a little daughter. When I meet her, together with her husband, Bismillah from Afghanistan, she has already accepted Islam and strictly observes Islamic hijab wearing the headscarf. Jasmin is deeply convinced that Islam is the only religion for her. She even broke ties with her family as they rejected her spiritual vocation. Now, driving all the way to Vienna, she wants to convert officially. Georgi Guguadze originates from a strict Orthodox Christian immigrant family. He's been living in Vienna since his early childhood. When I met him the first time in the mosque of Bayit ul Mutadin, I noticed him humbly washing the dishes of all members at the mosque after a festival, and he felt rather shy to me. Only much later, he admits he's been an Austrian box champion. Now we're meeting at his mother's new restaurant in Vienna. After his conversion, it took him a few years until he told his family. Up to this day, he's struggling with his father for his faith.
I decided to be Muslim when I was 18, so like we are talking at a young age here. I got up every night at 4 o'clock in the morning, and for a certain period of time, I used to pray like every night, God, please guide me the right path. The first time I got in touch with Islam was I was in a Christian school as a kid. I had a teacher, he was a practicing Muslim, so he was actually the first live example I saw as a practicing Muslim. And when I heard the first time somebody reciting the Quran, it was very touching, and I did not understand why these strange words, which I've never heard in my life before, which don't make any sense to me because I just don't understand them, why they're so strong. And I started crying like a small child. And I mean, you see, back then I did like boxing and I was this tough kid, you know, crying like a small kid. It was quite embarrassing, but I have no idea why. So somebody was reading the Quran. And so it had a very emotional impact on me all the time. Before I was a Muslim, I was on a search. And after I decided to become a Muslim, it was like, I mean, absolute calm. And it was clear for me now that this is the road I have to take. And it was clear that to reach my aim, to be close to Allah, to be close to God, and to be deserving of paradise, and to be a better human, and to be a better man, that this is the path I have to take. Now, only if I fail, and if I go back, and this is the only battle that I have. I woke up once morning, it was like clear as a day that I have to become a Muslim, and there was no other solution for me. So there was not a single doubt, not a single way back, and it was after the Muslim.
Conversion happens in Ismail Suk's mosque. Ismail has been trying tenaciously to help find converts who would be willing to document the process of converting. He also tells me young Austrians don't tend to make their conversion public and rather perceive it as an intimate process. Or they decide in short notice to take the step into a new religious life. Others even fear the resentment of their families. The long period of interaction between Austria and Islam is stretching back to 1525, when the Ottoman Sultans tried to invade the Austrian Empire. Although these attempts failed, there were significant cultural repercussions, and many Austrians adopted Islam. Some well-known Austrian converts are Muhammad Assad, Karl Hammerschmidt, Javidan Hanum, and Saltin Pasha. The true start of the legalization of Muslims' rights in Austria was issued in 1912 by Emperor Franz Josef I. Muslims in Austria are since then officially represented by the Islamic faith community. All this led to increased rights and privileges for Austria's Muslims. Women, for instance, are permitted to wear the veil at work and in public ceremonies. Students in public institutions too were permitted to veil, and Muslims gained the right to study Islam in state schools and in the army.
Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes, bienvenidos a una nueva emisión de La Hora de Irán. Es un placer estar con ustedes. Como siempre, agradecemos a todos los que nos siguen en cada programa y a quienes se unen por primera vez. Les recordamos que pueden participar y enviarnos sus comentarios y mensajes a través de nuestro sitio iranradio.ir. Hoy tenemos una programación especial para ti, diferente a los programas anteriores. El programa de hoy es en memoria del comandante mártir Qasem Soleimani, el comandante iraní que fue martirizado por los Estados Unidos de Norteamérica el 2 de enero de 2020. Así que no se despeguen de la radio. Vamos a empezar con una conversación sobre la personalidad del mártir Qasem Soleimani. Les invitamos a escuchar la primera parte de este programa especial.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. En el nombre de Dios, el misericordioso, el clemente. Muy buenos días, queridos hermanos y hermanas.